This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Connection is the greatest strength in the fight against suicide. Together, we can encourage those who are struggling to seek help and to know they're not alone. For free resources or to learn how you can get involved in their mission, visit afsp.org.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Before we get to our conversation about a Chicago building with a pretty wild and magical backstory, I want to remind you that you can hear a rundown of the latest stories happening here in the Chicago area at the end of this podcast. Now let's turn to the conversation you clicked on. The old McCormick building on Ontario Street has lived a lot of lives, from a mansion to a casino, a puppet theater to one of Chicago's classic steakhouses. And now it's entered a new era. The former home of Lowry's The Prime Rib has been transformed into The Hand and the Eye. That's an upscale magic venue where guests roam from room to room, catching magic shows over cocktails and dinner. But the magic isn't just happening on stage, it's in the building itself. So in this episode, for our series, What's That Building?, our architecture expert's going to dig into the history inside the building's walls and tell us about the magical reimagination of the historic space. At the table was Dennis Rodkin, In the Loop's architecture sleuth. Now, The Hand and the Eye has been open for a month now. But for those of us who haven't been to the historic building at all, I thought I'd get Dennis to orient us a bit. So he starts by telling us where exactly it's located. Here's Dennis.
100 East Ontario, which is Russian Ontario, okay. Just west of Michigan Avenue.
And you went there, you talked with its founder, Glenn Tolman, and he told you about this $50 million passion project. What'd you learn?
He did a lot. So one of the reasons to go was that we were there during the pandemic when Lowry's had just closed. Mm-hmm. And the question was, who could reuse this thing? It's this warren of dozens of rooms, various sizes. It's an old mansion engulfed by a second building in the 1940s. What is somebody going to do with this?
Right.
Well, he's the guy who figured out what to do with it. He was actually Tolman, who's a longtime healthcare entrepreneur, has been a magician since he was 8 years old, and apparently it was his dream, and his dream fit right into this building to create sort of it's hard to describe, but like a choose your adventure sort of
the multiple rooms fits into that.
Yeah, you go in and it's not that you go into a theater and a magician does a show in front of you. It's that you go into this building where there are dozens of rooms and there may be magic happening in the bar. There are actual auditoriums where there are magicians performing, but there are also small rooms that feel like you're in sort of a club, a very nice club. And so you wander through all this space.
There's just magic happening everywhere.
Exactly. There are dozens of magicians performing, some of them, again, in auditoriums, others just sort of as you pass.
Yeah.
And you also can have dinner there. And so this old sort of warren of rooms fit right into the dream that Glenn Tolman had.
I love that. He told you something that it's a Chicago-style magic, and you wrote that in your piece. Tell me what did he mean by that?
I was fascinated. I had no idea. You know, I'm a big fan of Chicago and Chicago history,
yes.
But I didn't realize there being a Chicago School of Architecture, there is a Chicago School of Magic. The primary proponent of it was a man named Matt Shulian, who turned his family tavern into a magic parlor of sorts. And he specialized in, and a lot of other Chicago magicians have specialized in, close-up work.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're sitting at the table with the person, you see the magician's hands in action. This is not David Blaine suspended in a tank.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know, something might be going on up there to help the magic, but you're so far away you can't tell. This isn't that kind of spectacle. We're sitting here at this table and you're performing magic at the table I'm sitting at. And that's one of the reasons all these rooms work, is that so many of them are set up. It feels like you and, you know, eight of your friends are sitting around a really nice banquet table or a really nice dining table, and the magician is there. There is a spotlight on the performer's hands, so you're actually seeing what's happening. But we're all sitting right there looking at what's going on while having drinks and talking and looking at magic memorabilia and things like that.
I love the idea of the close-up because I know me, and I would be trying to figure out, how did they do that?
You know what's funny is I think if you were a magician and a fan of magic, you'd be more likely to take them up on this, but there are also classes in magic. So if you've gone to some of these things and, like you, have said, how do they do that?
Right.
You can take classes in the building and learn how to do what they did.
So cool. There's also this tribute of sorts to the history of magic right there in the building. There are artifacts that Tolman has collected, right, over the years, and he's put on display inside the Hand in the Eye.
He says it may be the largest collection of magic artifacts in the world. There's not really a way to vet that statement, but he may be right. Some of the things that are in there are, there was a magician named Herman in the 19th century who did a decapitation trick.
Ooh.
And there was a cloth that he would use that in that trick. And when you're sitting in one of these rooms, that's sort of the decoration on the wall, is this cloth that was used in the decapitation trick. There's also a milk jug. One of Harry Houdini's most famous tricks is when he was handcuffed and put inside a milk jug, one of these big sort of metal barrels that milk would have been delivered in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
He would be handcuffed, put inside, and the lid locked down on top of him, and then he'd suddenly appear outside the jug.
Oh, wow.
And one of those jugs that Houdini actually used is there, as well as, it's kind of amazing, there's also a picture of the trick. So you really, you know, you're really walking through the history of magic while there is magic being performed.
And dare I say, secret passages are in the building as well? What
yes.
can you share?
Nothing. I was sworn to secrecy. Yes, I can confirm.
Hoping for an in-the-loop exclusive.
I was too, believe me. And I did get that in-the-loop exclusive, but under being sworn to secrecy.
Now, you just failed the entire assignment, Dennis.
I'm sorry, Sasha. I'm so sorry. But I will say, it's really fascinating because, I mean, you know, your whole experience is magic when you're in that building. And some of it involves secret passages, which, again, you know, if they had built a new building, certainly they could build these passageways here and there. But this makes use of some of the old spaces in the building. And people appear where you didn't expect them to. And
it's
pretty fascinating.
So the interior of the building's been mostly made over, as I understand it, Dennis. You're right, though, that there are still remnants from the past.
The primary one is when you're in kind of a main club area. It's not, you're on your way to a dining room. There's this big ornate staircase. And some people will tell you that that's from the McCormick Mansion. It is old. It's from the 1940s when a building was built around the McCormick Mansion, when it became the casino and later the puppet theater. But it's this, you know, you wouldn't build a staircase like this now. It's a very beautifully carved staircase and balcony that kind of brings you down. You imagine people in very fancy dress cascading down these stairs. That's one of the primary ones you'll see. But also, if you go into kind of a back staircase, you see, and Tolman's really excited to point these things out, you see the old brick wall of the original 1895 mansion that in 1947 became surrounded by this L-shaped addition. And so you see sort of, you know, you see the history of the building. You see, here's the old part. I'm in the new part, which has been redone.
And I like that. I have an appreciation for that.
And so does Tolman. It was, you know, it was nice to know that they didn't like whitewash that or put drywall over that wall or something like that. They have built in some references to history that aren't authentic, but are references to history. For example, when you're in one of the bars, the sort of steel girders of the ceiling are a reference to the L tracks. He's got Chicago on his mind as well as magic.
He's been thinking about that local connection for sure. When was the McCormick Mansion built and who lived there in the beginning?
This very fabulous family, the McCormicks. Cyrus McCormick and his brother come from West Virginia. They've invented the McCormick Reaper, which truly revolutionizes farming. This is in the middle of the 19th century, the 1800s, they move to Chicago because they want to be able to ship to farmers. And then they become really one of the most wealthiest and powerful, one of the most powerful and wealthiest families in America because their product is used all over the country and then all over the world. So the builders of this house are the third generation of that dynasty, Leander McCormick and his wife Constance. His father, also named Leander, had a house down the street. His great uncle, Cyrus, the founder of the dynasty, had another house just a little farther on. It was known as McCormickville not long after the Chicago Fire because this clan of super wealthy people are building. Right. I think there were five in all, but five McCormick houses, but there were other buildings attending to them.
And this one, as we talked about, you know, most recently before it became a magic house, was Lowry's The Prime Rib. Another one of those homes in McCormickville was a restaurant too, right, at one point.
Leander's father, Leander, had a house that is still standing. I think they're the only two that are still really visible. And that was Shea Paul for decades, and it was seen in the Blues Brothers movie.
Oh, cool.
And Danny Ecker in Cranes just reported that it's for sale for the first time in a very long time. Mm. So another of the McCormick houses is likely to undergo transition just as this one has just emerged from one.
So I should ask you about the exterior of the Hand in the Eye, a.k.a. the McCormick Mansion. What does the outside of the building look like?
Well, it looks like it did in 1947 when this addition was made. When you're on the Rush Street side, you can see the old brick mansion kind of popping up over the walls of this Danish castle that was built around it in 1947. When we went to the building 5 years ago, I described it as a castle crossed with a ranch house because it's got all this beautiful detail, these beautiful quatrefoils and gorgeous stained glass, but it's just a couple stories high. It looks like a long, squat building, but very well ornamented. And that's how it looks today. They've made one addition to the roof, to the top, that you don't really see, but that gives them a rooftop deck. But they have picked up those quatrefoils. They, by the way, they sank 80 piers down into the ground, 60 feet into the ground, to stabilize this old structure.
Oh, wow.
Which is great. You know, this thing could have been treated badly. It was not headed for demolition.
It tells me that it's here to stay long time.
Tolman says for 100 years. He says he stabilized it for the next century. So when you walk up, what you see is this smooth stone wall, looks like sort of an urban castle. Because again, it has these quatrefoil windows and stained glass. And you have no idea what's going to happen inside.
Yeah, and for what's the price tag? A whopping $225.
It's
$225 for a night full of magic.
For magic, and it's
and
so
food.
You have dinner, you have drinks, but again, you're not there to see one magic show. There's essentially a concierge. You look at a menu essentially, and like we know, this guy does the kind of magic we like, but we also want to see these women over here, and so they kind of program your night so that you flow from room to room. But yes, it's $225 a ticket.
Well, it sounds like a good time. I'm going to try and see if I can go at some point soon because I want to get the experience you did. But before I let you go, Dennis, real quick, tease what we're working on next.
Well, you'd better pack your sunglasses and flip-flops because you and I are spending the summer on the beach.
Yeah, baby. Our beach series. I'll leave them with that. Can't wait. Dennis Rodkin is a Crane Chicago Business senior real estate reporter. Thank you, Dennis.
Thanks, Sasha.
I'll see you on the beach very soon.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Connection is the greatest strength in the fight against suicide. Together, we can encourage those who are struggling to seek help and to know they're not alone. For free resources or to learn how you can get involved in their mission, visit afsp.org. www.theaterforthecultureofthecommons.org.
Now we'll turn to the top stories of the day, from the Pope's growing concerns about AI, to a preview of Sueños Music Festival, to the aftermath of the Crosstown Classic. We sat down with Ambar Colon, Chicago Sun-Times arts and culture reporter, Michael Puente, WBEZ reporter and Weekend Edition anchor, and Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor. I'm fresh off a week's vacation, and I was pleasantly surprised to come back to sunshine in Chicago. Wow! So we started off with a good old chit-chat about the weather.
The sun was out. It was a gorgeous Chicago weekend.
Because that's not what was happening when I left.
Maybe you brought it back.
Oh,
thank you for that.
So sweet. Mike, did you get any time outside?
Oh, absolutely. Did some yard work, but also had a chance to, I go to this big park where I live and took the dog and he gets to run around everywhere. It's
nice.
Very simple. And I'm also a big bird watcher. And
I
love watching
guessed.
Birds in my backyard. I like to even we get the Blue Jays and the Cardinals, but we get all these other great critters and stuff. But I also watched a little baseball over the weekend, too.
Did you? Well, we'll talk more about that, definitely. But first, I want you to catch us up on something else we missed, Mike. We love to keep up with the Pope news, and I'm hearing he's formed a study group on what?
He has formed a study group about the growing concern of AI, artificial intelligence. The church,
so even the Pope is weighing in on that.
Even the Pope is. He's concerned about the church is concerned about the dignity for every human being and the impact artificial intelligence is could have on the human race. So they're going to, it's part of the Pope Leo is going to release his first what's called an encyclical paper.
Okay.
Where it's going to sort of a roadmap of some of the things he's going to be talking about and concerned about during his papacy. So, and AI is definitely one of those things he's going to do. And of course, Pope Leo is a Chicago native and first American Pope. That's why we're so, into following him. And so AI is a big concern for him.
Yeah, he decided to create this in-house study group because of the acceleration, I think, in our use of AI. And it seems like the Vatican overall is growing in concern on this. I mean, what specifically is the group going to focus on?
I think it's going to focus on just on the impact on human beings, whether it's replacement of humans for jobs, but also just there's so many fake videos out there, just making sure we get a handle on it. I'm not sure if what Pope Leo comes out with is going to stop the growth of AI anywhere, but it's putting the brakes, not just in the United States, but of course around the world.
Because
what the Pope says, people pay attention to.
Well, certainly he has control over sort of the church's teachings.
Yes.
I mean, even during Morning Edition this morning, we're talking about AI. Psychiatrists and therapists are using this now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And some patients are having concerns with that. So, I think that this study can also look at AI's influence, within what the church is able to teach in schools and in mass, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, the connection didn't come to my brain immediately, but just thinking more on it, I mean, religion would have something to say, I think, about artificial intelligence. Any thoughts, Ambar? Is that a wild connection for you?
Yeah, honestly, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, in some people's eyes, I think AI is like inevitable, and we're going to see it in more and more spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope that like parishes are like asking their congregations about how they feel about AI. I hope that they're fact-checking homilies and things like that.
Oh, yes.
That's super important.
Yeah, let's pivot now, Claire. We've got some sad news. The owner of Billy Goat has died at the age of 91. What should we know about Sam Sianis?
Yeah, died of natural causes. Okay. Family says peacefully in his sleep at 91 years old. This was on Friday, but Sam opened the Billy Goat Tavern on Lower Michigan Avenue. This was back in 1964, 30 years after his uncle William opened the original location on West Madison Street. So his uncle William also has a little bit of Cubs lore.
Oh.
Was the legendary creator of the Billy Goat Curse on the Chicago Cubs back in 1945. So Cubs owner at the time, P.K. Wrigley, wouldn't let him bring his pet goat into a game.
Oh, wow.
And that is where the curse, sort of that myth of that came to be.
I've always wondered.
Right. But it was apparently broken when the Cubs won the World Series. Hate to remind Mike of that in 2016. but Sam became famous for that underground burger location, cheeseburger, yes. Not burger, burger.
Cheeseburger.
Yes,
cheeseburger.
A phrase that was popularized, as we know, on SNL with John Belushi. But for many who knew him, who spent time with him, that includes a lot of our Sun-Times journalists, Chicago Tribune journalists over the years.
That's right.
His brother said he was a very generous man, always wanted to help anybody out, all walks of life, that people just were sort of drawn to him and enjoyed him. And he became a part of Chicago in a lot of ways.
What you're describing too, Claire, I mean, it's a Chicago iconic staple, Billy Goat, right? We've got one right downstairs here at Navy Pier.
One of the cheapest things you can get to eat at the pier. Mike and I talk about this all the time.
Absolutely the best. I'm proud to say that one of my kids worked there for a couple of summers, and the staff is just amazing. They treated her like, you know, they had known her for years, and so she fit right in.
That's right.
It was the best first job a teen could have.
Best burgers, best pickles, and great breakfasts, too, for somebody else to get here in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Great breakfasts.
Yeah, I love my mozzarella sticks.
So there will probably be, you know, at some point, something that the public can pay attention to, some sort of gathering, and we'll keep you posted, nice. As we always do.
Now, Mike, you know what? There are a lot of Greek-owned restaurants in your corner of the world. I'm talking about Northwest Indiana, of course. I'm thinking of the ones that are, you know, owned by Greeks, but they serve everything, kind of like a Billy Goat. Also,
that's
you've
right.
got the more traditional ones, too.
Exactly, right. So sort of the when people say Northwest Indiana, you go to a Greek restaurant, they're talking about places like Petro's and Janelle's in Hammond, Round the Clock, Jedi's in Highland. It's a sort of they have a full menu, breakfast, lunch, dinner, everything. But, of course, there's also the traditional Greek restaurants, like Papa's in Crown Point, that great Greek Mediterranean grill in Crown Point. So you have like Athena's in Greektown.
Mm-hmm.
You have the traditional Greek restaurant, traditional servings, and the sort of everything on the menu.
Yeah. Umbar, didn't you have a story recently about a non-traditional Greek restaurant? What are they doing that's distinct?
Yeah. So I wrote about the new restaurant Kukla's up in Niles. It's coming from... he's a fourth generation chef, really big Chicago chef, coming from the Banos family. His dad ran Heaven on Seven. So I'm talking about Jimmy Banos Jr. He and his partner, Kevin Steck, they used to work at the Purple Pig. They've left a couple years ago to work on this concept, which is a contemporary Greek. They're mixing a little bit of the old with the new. So they've got, you know, inspiration from Jimmy Jr.'s grandparents. And also they're taking on a lot of like modern takes on their dishes. They're importing a lot of great things from Greece, including olive oil, of course, Greek truffles. They're working with a lot of local butchers and local ingredients. I've been told they're working on a spring menu, so we'll see that
very soon. Check them out.
Everything was delicious when I went there. And I think the star of the restaurant is their live fire grill. It was a custom-built grill. They're putting oak and olive wood in there. So it's everything that you get on the grill is going to have delicious flavor.
I'm such a fan of Greek food. It's so good.
Yeah, and everything there is good. And don't sleep on their olive oil.
Yeah.
I mean, people often think of Italy for the best olive oil. Greek and Spain, really delicious.
Now, Claire, that huge music festival, Lollapalooza, it's coming back, but they're also doing something pretty special. They're giving money to Chicago public schools.
Showing up for the kids.
Yeah, I love that.
CPS is getting a $1.7 million grant from Lollapalooza to, of course, expand its arts education programming. So most of this funding will support in-school arts programs. So what, you know, students are doing day-to-day at CPS.
And $1.7 million, that's a lot of money.
So this isn't a new partnership. Lolla has been giving money to CPS for quite some time, long-term partnership, but this is one of the largest gifts that CPS has ever received for its arts programming. The gift brings the festival's total support for CPS since 2021 to $3.9 million.
Wow.
The district saying that this round of funding will reach more than 40,000 students over the next 5 years.
That's amazing. Now, Lala is not until later this summer, Umbar, but there is a music festival that's coming up on Memorial Day weekend, which is right around the corner. Give us a preview.
Yeah. So Sueños Music Festival is kicking off this weekend. It's the fifth year that it's happening. We've got headliners from J Balvin to Kali Uchis on day one. Day two has Fuerza Regida, so Mexican regional music, which is increasingly popular. And then Yandel is bringing an orchestra. He's bringing his Sinfonico. live album tour.
So they're coming out the gate from day one.
Yeah, so it'll be a great weekend. I'll be on the ground there Saturday, and I'm looking forward to it, as always, especially the food. The food is probably my
favorite
part.
And fashion. I love the Sueños outfits.
Yeah, the Crosstown Classic. I've never seen anything like it. We had the Cubs and the Sox. Claire, Mike, who is wearing a Sox jersey, might I add.
It was fantastic.
What did y'all
baseball.
Think?
I think overall this was one of the best Crosstown Classics in terms of action, in terms of the actual game, in years, Mike.
Well, yeah, part of it is because my team hasn't been that great, but we are coming back. Look, I've been to a lot of Crosstown Classics. I didn't go to this past weekend, but there's been so many memorable ones, including 20 years ago, the anniversary of when Michael Barrett punched A.J. Przinski. First time the Cub Sox ever got into a fight on the field. And that was great, but there was almost a fight between PCA, Pecor Armstrong, and a fan.
That rogue fan.
At White Sox. You know, people are making a big deal about it, but I just love it. We do know the Sox are going to, you know, they're going to get
they're
a lot of ribbing
trash
when they get up to Wrigley Field.
So wait, there was almost a fight at this one?
There were words exchanged between Cubs center fielder Pecor Armstrong and a fan, because at Sox Park, they've got, you know, sort of these cages where you're at field
level. Yeah.
So a fan, a female fan, will say she was getting a little trash talky with PCA. But again, this is the theme. I mean, when going in high school to these games, you're starting to talk trash on the train, on the ride down, right? That's just sort of the nature of this.
No, that was just you, Claire.
It might have been. And we'll tell you about how
like
I ended
Claire
up in the infirmary in high school either.
Were you the female fan?
I was nowhere near Sox Park over the weekend.
I'm kidding.
But it was, I think PCA succumbed a little bit. Contentious, you know, fans, people talking. There was a lot of excitement. And not to mention that the Sox were home run hitting around the clock all
crazy.
Weekend.
Munetaka Murakami, just Colson Montgomery, Miguel Vargas. And
Vargas,
of course,
too.
Edgar Carroll, the winner, the hero of yesterday's game. The thing that's so great about the rivalry and the heatedness of it, about the fan, everywhere you go in the city, primarily, the Cubs are loved. They everywhere, you know, PCA, all of them, they go around town, Cubs.
Yeah, they have the romantic story.
Then they go
story.
To this one section of the city that where they are not loved, and they're still in Chicago, and they're they're hearing it, and it's got to be a little jarring for them and a little fun.
And I think the players were very appreciative, too, of just of the competitiveness. You know, they like the electricity. They like the rivalry.
Oh, it sounds like such a good time overall.
And it was a packed house. I mean, tickets were going for almost $200 when I glanced
Sheesh.
Yesterday.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, the real question is, will Umbar be trash-talking at her game tonight, because you're checking out the Cubs and Brewers.
Yeah,
that's a big one.
Yeah, so another, maybe not as iconic as the Crosstown rivalry, but a good baseball rivalry.
Very.
I love baseball. I love Chicago baseball, so this should be a fun night. And yeah, I'm just looking forward to being at the friendly confines.
It's actually arguably a more important series for the Cubs against Milwaukee. Milwaukee and the Cubs. Huge rivals. Cubs still have a great team, could make the World Series this year, but they can't let the disappointment of this past emotional series get in the way of this next series with Milwaukee.
Yeah, all I have to say is that during this past week, there was some sort of like spirit day at my kid's high school, and they had to represent their favorite Chicago team. I was able to provide her with a closet full of Sox gear. So she was able to, she looked kind of like you, Mike, you right now.
You know, let's give a little love to Bruno Mars, who came into the city, just packed the house, Soldier Field. I know a lot of people who went. I wish I could have went, but those ticket prices were up there. So he's certainly one of the top performers around the world. So,
well, before I let you go, tell me what else is on your radar. What other stories are you following, Umbar?
Yeah, so I have a story coming up tomorrow about Chicago's rising phone-free culture. So it's becoming more and more common that venues and event organizers are asking people to check their phones at the door. And what that does is create a more immersive experience. It also takes away the crutch of the cell phone, especially if you're at an event and maybe you don't know as many people, you're super tempted. You're going to be super tempted to scroll.
Right.
So
interesting.
Without the phone as a crutch there's a lot of interesting conversations and things happening. There's a show kicking off tomorrow by Producing Body, which is a smaller theater company here in Chicago. The show is called Spaceman, and they're using Yonder pouches. So when you check in, they're going to make you shut your phone off and then lock
like
the phone up.
Kind of like what they do at schools, right?
Yeah.
Middle schools, high schools.
Exactly.
Ooh, I don't know how I would survive, but I like the way that this is going. Mike, what are you checking out this week?
You know, there's always a free-for-all. There's a lot of things happening. I think, you know, what a lot of discussion is about over this past weekend about some of the elections that took place elsewhere where Republican incumbents lost because they didn't have the backing of Donald Trump. There's a lot of talk about what's going to happen in Northwest Indiana come the fall because you have a number of, at least one candidate incumbent who lost their race to a Trump-backed Republican, but how is that going to translate into power at the State House in Indiana? So, like everybody, the economy, the gas prices, we do, you know, just a lot of things going on.
We'll keep an eye out for those stories. That's WBEZ's Michael Puente and Claire Lane and Ambar Colon with the Sun-Times. This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, just head to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.